So I will now hand over to Franz, whose presentation is called Representing World, Observations from Arctic Hunter-Gatherers on Social Media. And he will take us to the Mackenzie Delta, and his presentation should be digested with a pinch of salt, as he termed it yesterday. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Manon, and thanks for coming back after the break. Since this is a workshop, I'm really trying out some things that I have not done before here, and talk about social media, which is not really my field. But since we're talking about ways of representing our research and of engaging with publics, I think social media is obviously something we cannot ignore. Last weekend, the Delta Project's Twitter account had 297 followers, and its Facebook page 198 followers. The Cologne Department of Anthropology was followed by 585 people on Facebook. 2,898 Facebook users were signed up for following the Global South Study Center, and 63,650 for following the University of Cologne. Furthermore, 39,553 people were following the university on Twitter and 11,924 on Instagram. We have been using our project's social media to share news and announce events concerning the project and related work. The department and the university occasionally share our content, and we sometimes share theirs. However, we have not used these channels to communicate our research findings. There are multiple reasons for this, one of which is probably our reluctance to catapult images, stories, and observations into a digital space that is widely known for its corporate domination, insidious algorithms, and dodgy privacy policies, where their spread, use, and perhaps abuse would be out of our hands. Another challenge is what and how to post in order to engage potential readers while not limiting our messages to trivial or simplistic texts or stereotyping images. And then there are issues of confidentiality and ethics that may extinguish even the last remaining motivation to post about our research insights on social media. Considering social media as potential challenges, as potential channels to reach wider and including non-academic audiences, thus adds a number of challenges to the already manifold classic problems of representation that we've heard about from Werner this morning. Does that mean we should stay away from social media? While I believe that there are many reasons to be cautious, I also think that this question, before addressing it in one way or another, warrants a closer look at social media practice among our research participants. As I began my fieldwork in the Mackenzie Delta in the Canadian Northwest Territories, I soon noticed that social media, especially Facebook, YouTube, and Snapchat, played an important role among the people with whom I was working. For example, most organizations involved in administering the land claims that the two indigenous groups of the Delta have been successfully negotiated recently, and with whom I was interacting in the process of negotiating my own access to the field, these organizations main very active Facebook pages. One of these land claim groups are the Inuvialuit, who represent the Inuit of the Western Canadian Arctic. Apart from the General Inuvialuit Regional Corporation, which manages their interests and assets, and the Joint Secretariat, which is responsible for co-management of wildlife and environments in the Inuvialuit settlement region, each population center in the region has its own so-called Hunters and Trappers Committee, or HTC, that has far-reaching rights in land use management in its respective area. Dealing with the HTC of Aklavik, the Delta settlement that I ended up living in and learning about most, I began to understand that their Facebook presence was mostly used to communicate with its own constituency, that is, the Inuvialuit members residing in Aklavik. It shared news about planned research or development projects, it circulated job and training opportunities, most of which came through InnoVialuit organizations, and it kept people up to date on upcoming meetings or related events. The other land claim organization in the Delta is the Gwich'in Tribal Council, which represents the people in and around the Delta who belong to the northernmost Dene First Nation in Canada. Similar to the InnoVialuit organization, the Gwich'in too have a resource co-management administration and local agencies in their respective population centers. Initially, I dealt mostly with the council's Department of Cultural Heritage, which maintains a lively Facebook presence too. Rather than everyday practical matters of jobs, meetings, and projects, this page focuses on sharing stories or explaining artifacts from its large and growing collection of Gwich'in heritage. It seems to be addressing as much Gwich'in people as outside audiences. Once a week, they publish a story or set of pictures from their own collection. They have also created posts about my research project and a recent publication that emerged from the fieldwork, which Manon mentioned earlier, the Delta Methods. So we have been communicating through that on Facebook. Apart from the official land claim organizations, also a lot of everyday communication takes place on social media, especially on Facebook again. For the settlement of Aklavik, there is a buy and sell group, an events and announcements group, a group for selling traditional arts and crafts, a group for the popular sing-along circle, and a few others. And alongside these informal groups, the people of Aklavik, most of whom have access to smartphones, tablets, or computers, are prolific social media users as well. Facebook and YouTube are only two of the platforms they use, but I did not have access to the others, including Snapchat and Instagram. But many Aklavik residents already use Facebook so frequently that my wife felt compelled to undergo a Facebook detox treatment towards the end of our stay in the settlement, deleting the app of her phone and unfollowing all but a few of her friends. So much we've been involved in this Facebook world cloud eddy of that place while we were there. As in many places around the world, Mackenzie Delta people circulate jokes, memes, and pictures, comment on the weather, make announcements and advertisements, document everyday as well as exceptional activities, complain about neighbors or other people, communicate how they feel, send greetings and prayers, ask for help and advice, share news items and other readings that they came across, and post about many other things. During events that seem to be of particular interest to the people in and around the settlement, including dances, music and other performances, snowmobile races, lottery draws, or the breaking up of the river ice around the Aklavik, one or more people would even broadcast live on Facebook through their smartphone cameras. As I met more people in and around the Aklavik, and more people became my Facebook friends, I noted some recurrent themes in the incessant stream of utterances from my social media contacts. Without having ever made a quantitative assessment of this, I found it striking that so many posts were about journeys, visits, and visitors, about hunting or trapping success and sharing their catches, and about statements of abstinence from cigarettes and alcohol. The Facebook world that I was witnessing, I'm using the word witnessing since following would be a misleading term as it always eluded my closest scrutiny due to its sheer volume. So this Facebook world had, on the one hand, a general Facebook site, as I knew it from different European contexts, but it also had a firmly local bent, reflecting activities and events that were relevant especially to my Arctic research participants. Posts and images about where people were traveling, whether it was for hunting, for seeing family, for shopping, or for faraway holidays, who they were meeting or visiting, or who they had come to visit, or who had come to visit them, were fairly popular. It did seem to matter to the authors how the places and people they encountered were doing, how the road, flight, river, or trail conditions were, and what news they learned from visitors or hosts. Also, posts about animals that people came across during their trips or who came by their camp or settlement houses were not infrequent. Some of my friends' Facebook posts are blotted out in my news stream, since they contain images of hunted animals being skinned and butchered. Such hunting stories, whether successful or unsuccessful, make up another discernible share of the content on my Facebook. Successful hunters and trappers often show and enumerate the animals they have caught, and sometimes add a list of other animals that they have seen, while unsuccessful ones are limited to documenting the latter or to mentioning that they have not seen anything. In many cases, the successful hunting posts go hand in hand with comments or separate posts that address the sharing of some of the fish or meat harvested. Either the hunter proudly announces that she, or mostly he, has given this or that to relatives or elders, or the recipient takes to social media to announce their gratitude for the gift. Both the traveling visiting and the hunting sharing content are regularly met by commentaries on the value of carrying on tradition, on the beauty and richness of the land, and on the cultivation of respect to elders. People often apply the same commentaries, plus a religious trope, to posts regarding the authors not smoking or drinking for a particular amount of time. This can be read, I think, in the context of a general discourse on the problems of substance abuse, diabetes, and health, where alcohol, tobacco, and sugar are both ubiquitous and ubiquitously seen as problematic. Social media reflects and verbalizes this tension. It was not long into my fieldwork before I too began to post about trips or events in which I had participated. Just like other people in the Klavik made explicit the places they had visited, the people they had been with, and their gratitude for what they had received, I wrote short thank you notes to acknowledge some of the trips and events. This in turn had repercussions in the real world, as people would sometimes mention or ask me about one of the occasions about which I had posted earlier. Consequently, I made all my thank you posts public, so that more people would be able to see them and potentially talk to me about my work. Alongside directly creating, sharing, and commenting content on social media, Delta inhabitants were also well-versed in other ways of digital documentation. Some were keen nature photographers. Others were experienced survey takers. Not only various external research projects paid Delta inhabitants to carry out surveys with their peers. Also, the Inuvialuit Regional Corporation is conducting a long-term harvest study to monitor how many animals of what species were taken on their land and to trace environmental changes. Some of the local contract workers fill out paper surveys and later enter the results in the tablets provided for this task. Others conduct the surveys with the tablets directly. So there's social media and electronics and gadgets and all that anywhere. Only after a few months into the fieldwork did I realize that the high-speed internet in people's homes and offices and the wide-ranging mobile phone reception around the Klavik were rather recent phenomena in the Delta. While a Klavik had had private landline telephones for a few decades, mobile phone reception and internet had only been introduced respectively 3 and 4 years prior to my fieldwork. One Klavik resident commented that people would just yell out of their windows more often before they had social media. There's 500 people living in a Klavik, so rather a small place. Others tell me that, of course, they used to have mobile phones before they had reception. The town of Inuvik, located at the edge of the Delta, 3 hours by summertime boat ride, 1.5 hours by wintertime ice road, or 20 minutes by plane away, had mobile phone transmission posts years before one was established in the Klavik, so people sent their phones along with those who had errands to run in Inuvik, reading and composing their text messages in the Klavik, but sending and receiving them remotely, in Inuvik. Others even claim that on good days, they had been able to receive a weak signal from Inuvik on the roof of the highest building in Iqaluit. But all these stories, even though referring to only a few years in the past, are now firmly placed in the lore of a bygone era. In fact, this bygone era had another means of communication, namely shortwave community band radio. Every camp in the Delta has still a high antenna for this purpose, and every larger boat is equipped with a radio. Even in some of the houses in the settlement, a shortwave radio is installed in a central position, and its crackling sounds mix with those of the high-definition television set that stands next to it. While shortwave radio remains an important technology for boat and, during the winter, car and truck transport, its use for communication between homes has largely been replaced by mobile phones and the internet. Even many camps in the Delta rely less on shortwave radio and more on the mobile phone network, for which some families have bought signal amplifiers that are now attached to the old radio antennas. Needless to say, these technologies consume more electricity than a shortwave radio that ran with a simple battery, but a generator that also runs the camp's lights, refrigeration, and other electrical household appliances has become standard in most camps anyway. In today's world of intense social media use, not all Delta dwellers are equally fond of the technology and its utilization. Many people post, comment, and share multiple times a day and hours on end. Others engage less frequently, and yet others only have profiles but hardly ever actively engage in the platforms. Some Iqaluit inhabitants have complained to me that social media is used to gossip about one another in the settlement rather than confronting each other and settling potential quarrels instead of amplifying them in the social media. One person who was of this opinion explained that the problem explained this problem to me once when we stood next to the Iqaluit airstrip, where a pickup truck was parked in a wrong spot. He said that most people he knew would now probably take a picture of the vehicle, post it on social media, and criticize the driver's behavior. Many readers of this message would get angry, and most of them would know whose vehicle this was. As I said, 500 people in the settlement. The post would gather a number of comments that would further aggravate people's anger, but nothing would be done about the truck. My companion said that since he also knew whom the truck belonged to, and since he had seen that person earlier in the two-room airport building, it would be easy to just ask him to move his vehicle. As if to prove his point, my interlocutor did enter the building, and the driver soon emerged to park his truck elsewhere. Needless to say, many other confrontations were avoided by people posting their grievances on social media instead. In my reading, however, some of these episodes were not so foreign to the usual way of Iqaluit people dealing with potential conflict, which was usually avoidance. It seemed fine to discuss negative things about other people in their absence, but unspeakably rude, and therefore very rare, to tell them straight into their faces. Conflict avoiding practices are known from hunter-gatherer groups around the world, and social media might just have added a new set of techniques to their repertoire. While the opinions, practices, and amounts of social media in the Mackenzie Delta, social media use in the Mackenzie Delta, thus clearly differ between people, there is no doubt that in all their diversity, they create a large body of self-representations, of representations of others, and of observations and reflections on what matters to them. This means that to some extent, they provide a host of information, not only to us as researchers, but also to some of those publics that we might be interested in reaching with our social media, with our own social media campaigns. The art of the researcher then becomes less that of a collector and producer of data than that of an editor and perhaps translator, who selectively shares and comments some of their research participants' posts. Such an approach that would treat social media activity as research material is reminiscent of previously established research methods where the ethnography distributes cameras to research participants for exploring their point of view, or distributes journals and asks people to keep diaries to gather their own observations and reflections. Where people are already as skillful with cameras and other technologies and as active on social media as many inhabitants of the Mackenzie Delta, these physical proxies and external motivations may no longer be needed. However, we may consider, or we may want to consider, people's social media activity as more than mere data or research material. In fact, it could be argued that what we are dealing with are already representations, already theories and interpretations that we must take seriously in their own right and in conversation with our own. This latter approach is based on the realization that our academic representations and interpretations are only some among others, including people's Facebook posts. It is not for us exclusively to construct hierarchies of theory making, and we must not shirk away from a truly decolonial treatment of what has been called indigenous knowledge, nor we define what is indigenous and what is not, what counts as knowledge and what does not, and where data collection ends and theory building begins. Furthermore, the specific temporality in which these representations appear and unfold is already a potentially useful inroad into this, perhaps more humble approach to social media content. Granted, the companies behind the large platforms like Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Snapchat keep optimizing the algorithms that determine when we see what posts and how many of them are direct or indirect advertisements based on their calculations of consumer behavior, etc. So that they're not actually geared to be research machines or theory machines. And users in the field, as much as in academia, are certainly susceptible to these calculations. Nevertheless, we could argue that the constant stream of content and comments that we experience when indulging in these technologies does something more profound yet. The ephemerality of the posts, especially on Snapchat, but the same is true for users with a sufficiently large number of relations on the notoriously difficult to search Facebook and Instagram, this ephemerality performs a kind of representation that is more like evolving conversation than a set of fixed images or structures. It is very hard to return to content posted a week ago, if we do not remember who exactly posted it, and content from a year ago will be almost impossible to find in profiles as active as those of many Mackenzie Delta inhabitants. Representation, then, is clearly an enacted process that is carried forward by the practice of social media users. Any images are necessarily blurred. But is there not still a wide gap between the people's and the researchers' representations? Can our work as ethnographers and anthropologists really be broken down to the level of social media posts? Of course, in some areas, there are huge differences between professional anthropological and everyday Delta inhabitant representations. Take, for example, the gap between a journal article and a tacit gesture. These are both kinds of representations that include lots of theory, but you can't really compare them, or at least they're not on the same level. In other arenas, however, these differences might not be as insurmountable, and social media may be a case in point. Both researchers and research participants use the medium to communicate to themselves and to others something that they find meaningful and worth sharing, given a certain limitation of the respective technologies and technologies format. I suggest we might take this convergence as an opportunity, both to communicate with audiences beyond the academy and to take people's statements seriously. Then we should be able to engage in a common conversation that includes different Delta dwellers, researchers, and publics. This is by no means an easy undertaking. For one thing, we must remain sensitive editors of the content we share and discuss in order not to compromise Delta dwellers in relation to other audiences who are likely not aware of the specific context that gave rise to the respective content. This caveat may have political or legal dimensions, but certainly also applies to questions of spelling and visual aesthetics. There is little use in making our research participants appear as literate half-wits with a predisposition for kitsch. We must also keep asking ourselves to what extent a particular social media content is indeed a public statement. While it inherently embodies an interest in sharing and broadcasting, the particular public that it has originally been directed towards may be the settlement or family and friends near and far. Nevertheless, many statements in Mackenzie Delta inhabitants' social media feeds are indeed geared at a wider public, and these deserve being picked up and engaged in our conversations. For instance, an Eklavik resident with the username of Muskrat411 has been posting videos from his trapline, hunting trips, and other occasions on YouTube for years, and is followed by over 4,000 people, most of whom live outside of the Delta. Inspired by wilderness TV shows and other genres, this person is interested precisely in portraying a way of life of the Delta to strangers. Therefore, in order to contribute our share in developing the understanding and analysis of the predicaments, live worlds, and trajectories of Delta dwellers, we may be well advised to engage in public exchanges with them on various social media platforms. This may simultaneously provide us with opportunities and contents to communicate our emerging research findings to non-academic audiences through these social media. As many Delta inhabitants already produce constant streams of representations documenting their activities, surroundings, and feelings, it may be worth the while to dialogically relate to them in our own attempts at understanding and representing them, and thereby to experiment with social media as forms of knowledge creation and dissemination, even if the very medium teaches us that there is no final word in the conversation.
Thank you for your interesting presentation. So we got 15 minutes for questions and comments. Any questions? Everyone is overwhelmed.
Just a comment. I think we are friends on Facebook, aren't we?
Yeah.
So sometimes I get your pictures from your field work, and I read it with great interest, of course. Sure. And you said it's difficult to do research on Facebook itself, so you cannot travel back, really?
I think it's,
how
yeah.
How do you store the... do you take pictures of the posts, or how do you store them?
You well, you know, before this workshop, I've never really thought about it, and that's now a problem. Because I remember, I remember sitting at home writing field notes, and my Facebook is on, and I see stuff that's happening, or somebody saying, "Oh, about time to go check the trap line," and then that made me actually call them and say, "Hey, can I come along?" and these sort of things. So there, I should have then made a screenshot, for instance, of that
screenshot
of that place, of that post, and. And documented it this way, but I didn't, because I thought, oh, you can always go back, and going back in my Facebook is very easy, because there's just not so much on it. But going back on other people's Facebook is impossible, really.
I
don't
know. Disappear a little bit.
I don't know, actually. They might, yeah. But I don't actually understand it, and that's why I'm referring to these algorithms. They're not made for that. They're made for consumer practices. Right, so
it's difficult for research then.
Yeah,
it happens permanently, because if you have the social media, you every day get news from the field.
Yeah.
You don't know where to store it and how to store it and
yeah.
where to put it.
So I think screenshots make sense, and because the other thing, you can on Facebook you can save posts. Actually, you can. There is on the top right there is a little menu, and it says save post, and then my Facebook keeps complaining every so often that. You have 120 saved posts, but you haven't looked at them, these kind of things. So there is somewhere or another, but while I was there, I was just not, I thought it's handy to have this, for instance, to say thank you, but as a research tool, I wasn't using it at all. I was, for instance, sometimes downloading the pictures that people would post. But that is scaringly easy too. You can just download a picture, and it's not great quality, but it's still a picture. But then you don't have the whole posting around. And you also don't have the fact that every year, Facebook reminds people of what they have been posting last year. So something might come back this year from that. I've had that happen from the fieldwork. If you go on my Facebook, the second post or something is somebody who remembered that they had posted about particular kind of liquor that comes from Estonia, and then it happened so that I saw the post and I gave her one of those bottles, and she was super happy, and so now Facebook tells her that again, that 2 years ago she did that. And so here we go again with a second wave of comments and reactions. So yes, it is not an archive in the sense of fixing things, but is this like very messy place.
And on the messiness, are you able to share a little bit more about the ethical questions of, presumably you're friends with these people, you've gone on kind of trips with them, but how, and you're part of those groups in order to be able to see and access, but where do you feel that the question of intention, so the intention of the individual who's just posting happy boat trip, then comes in your interpretation of that, and are people aware of who's listening, who's watching, etc.?
No, that's of course a core question, and I haven't blotted out any names, and you know when everybody got married now and all these kind of things. I don't have a clear answer for this, but I have a sort of an inclination, and that hinges on sharing. So people share stuff on social media, and they share it with their friends, or they share it with their contacts, or they share it publicly so that everybody can see it. And I think particularly when they share it with friends and they make me one of these contacts, then I have sort of the responsibility to keep sharing or to not share. So is it something that I think can be shared, for instance, in this circle? Now that's why, for instance, I didn't mind the names, because I know we are like colleagues here. This is a limited, it's not going online or something, you know. But there is no problem sharing these names and dates of marriage with you guys, because it's not going to be a problem. But in other settings, it might not. So it's an ongoing ethical tension, I suppose, where you or I have to think what. Does that sharing, what responsibilities and limitations come with sharing? And and so here, for instance, I think it's fine, in other contexts it might not be.
Maybe it's not that much a question, but more some thoughts. And one is, one thing I see or felt is that kind of when you were then at home, this kind of field work continued, but I think we also have to reflect on which who, because you were friends with some people, and the people you said that also that some people posted a lot and not others, so it raises also this question, I think, of maybe exclusion, inclusion. When I think of my context more, I mean, there are only maybe three people who have access and more or less stable internet, but it would raise a lot of questions of, I mean, there are some people posting on the Taik life and kind of stuff, but mostly people also who live, who are richer, who can read and write. So it kind of creates these questions also. We are following, but it's always some people and who are maybe dominant in that, or maybe also in what about the older or, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. That's, thanks a lot for that comment. That's absolutely true and important to keep in mind that we're here talking about. I think you saw probably three pictures from Diggy Ross, because That's like when I was the day before yesterday or yesterday making this, I was like, oh, I need, you know, some posts to some illustrate this. And I was like, oh, Diggy always posts, so let's look at his profile. Oh, and here we go, exactly what I was thinking. And then who's a hunter who posts a lot? Ah, Dhamma is, okay, so put search for Dhamma. Yes, it is very much skewed towards that kind of those people who would who have access and who are more prolific, let's say. And we must not take this as a one-to-one representation of what's going on. Absolutely. Exactly like you say, older people are less likely to use it. Interestingly, usually there's more women active on Facebook than men there, and a few other things. Of course, if you are an unemployed alcoholic, you're not likely to have a working phone than if you have an office job where you have very little to do but a very nice internet connection. Mm. Thanks.
So I take you first.
Thank you very much for the interesting information. From your presentation, I have an impression that you as a researcher are very much in a position as a passive observer of the whole process that is happening within this whole social media, Facebook, and your interlocutors. I want to know your opinion about how is it to become an engaged participant within this whole social media activeness with your interlocutors, and how do you find your role in there? That's one thing. And then also, because I myself is also a very active Facebook user myself, and then like my interlocutors are women fishermen in my own province, and like you said, like only two or three of them who are belonging to this privileged class of the fishermen group who have access to Facebook, and they are also connected with me. And the thing is that I also very, my question will be much more on the issue of security of information that we distribute in the Facebook and social media itself. Like for instance, like with these women fishermen, because I'm doing research in the location where it has a very political, very tough political situation that relates to the resource extraction in their area, because it relates to bauxite mining, this whole big resource companies that is very politicized locally and nationally. So there's an issue of security. So my engagement with them in social media on that issue is I tend to be very kind of like selective in putting the information, because I also have this urge as an activism from my side, but then I kind of like tend to be very selective in putting up all the information that I got from the field in order to how do you call it, like I do not want my interlocutors know how I interpret the phenomena that I found in their livelihood space based from a political point of view and political analysis that I did there. So I kind of like, in the end, what I'm putting out, right, information on the Facebook, where they can read also, is very much of this very, I will call it neutral information about their livelihood area. I will be posting my outings to their fishing space, for instance, but I will not say about how their fishing space is being destroyed by the company and the internal conflicts that happens there. I will keep it out of the
mm-hmm.
social media kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. So there's a process of selectiveness
yeah.
in my position as well.
Yeah.
So how do you see it as a, if you yourself as an engaged
yeah.
researcher in this whole process?
Thanks for that. As I said, we haven't actually done that very much in the project at all yet, and to really engage that. But when I was preparing this, I was thinking we should actually do that more. And editing is, I think, one of the words that I try to bring up a couple of times, that this is actually super important, of course, that we don't compromise people in the field. But having said that, I think that's something that we do anyway with other ethnographic findings as well, that we have to always be cautious to what do we communicate in what way, not to cause more problems for our research participants, right? So so I think there's actually a clear continuity between things we find out on social media and other speech acts, if you want to call it that, from our fieldwork. So yes, we should engage with them. We should maybe share some or comment them and these kind of things. But always there has to be we can't just do that with everything. But we have to be careful editors, and that is also linked very much with Eva's question about ethics and what do we share and how.
How about digital literacy? Is it a problem that you have thought about? Like, do people understand how social media works and what it offers, what is private, how to share? What do you think about this? Do they trust everything that they find from internet? Is it an issue?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, people are very critical of all sorts of media there, and they're critical of anything official, and they're very much their own sort of researchers. And one of those resources for that is actually the internet. So sometimes they get very excited about some things that they find. It's a great breeding ground for conspiracy theories and all that, but yes, I think people are quite aware of different levels of publics and different possibilities and limitations of internet. Perhaps in a slightly different register than us. For instance, one thing is about confidentiality, that not everybody, but most of the people that I spoke to and have, you know, how these days you need consent forms and all these kind of things in research, especially with indigenous communities in Canada. Most people were very happy about sharing their names, for instance, having their names attached to what they say, because that's their account, and they're proud that it's them. And I think it carries over into, for instance, social media use, that this is their post and their story. Again, we have to take this in the context that we know and have to think that might this particular utterance harm this person or not. But I think, yeah, there is that awareness of what the internet can do, and that they have an authorship.
Okay, one more question.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm interested in how you were talking about social media sort of extending the idea of criticism or complaints and this informal way or around the edges way of it. And I wanted to know maybe about this question of participant observation, whether even being a part of this network and seeing the complaints without them being addressed, whether you're actually engaging in that complaint of its own accord. And then also, how did you find out what was right and what was not right about your work? Did that play out in terms of how people responded to your posts or didn't? Like, how does this idea of going around the edges to complain about something, rather how you were involved in complaining about others, and do people complain about you when you found out new things through the social media space rather than the face-to-face?
Yeah, thanks. That's a super good question. I'm trying to think, Probably if people had something to complain about me, I wouldn't have noticed, because it wouldn't be confrontative, and I must have missed it on social media if it ever was there. Because yeah, people it would be clear, sort of, but not direct. Yeah, becoming sort of, the other part was being complicit in these.
In this culture of.
I mean, in a way, there is no way around that, because it comes up in conversations and in group discussion, and this person is, you know, always chasing the caribou with their snowmobile, and that's so bad for the caribou, and then that person enters and they talk about something else, you know. Yes, you become part of that, not only on social media. I must say that I am a really sluggish social media user compared to many of the people there, and particularly those like Diggy that I've shown. And I'm not commenting on everything that goes around. But as I said, there is also a continuity between what goes on in social media and what goes on in other forms of communication, and this talking around the edges was definitely part of that. And you learn a lot, of course, not only about the people who were trespassing, but also about the other people who are policing the rules.
Okay, so thank you, Franz, for this interesting presentation and for the interesting questions and discussion. I think a lot of it links up to what we will talk about after lunch, the roundtable on journalism and anthropology, like in terms of ethics, media use, and like being editors or maybe translators. So the lunch will take place here. And if you want to, you could put the tables together and just there's a buffet, you can just grab lunch, and we continue in an hour, at 1:30. Thank you.